This is Dr. David Black, founding director of the American Mindfulness Research Association, an associate professor at the University of Southern California. My guest today is Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, where he founded its world-renowned mindfulness-based stress reduction clinic in 1979. The program continues at that clinic and now in clinics and community centers around the globe 42 years later. Jon is the author of many well-known mindfulness meditation books, including Full Catastrophe Living, which is the classic MBSR manual. It is published in 10 languages, and it was first published in 1990, and I enjoyed a new edition that came out in 2013. Over 700 medical centers and clinics use the MBSR model, and his curriculum and early research program is what inspired my entire career. So I'm very happy to have you. Welcome, Dr. Kabat-Zinn.
Thanks so much, David. It's great to be here.
And in so many ways, Jon, you have articulated the elements and philosophies of a curriculum that I mentioned is so robust and applied in so many ways across many countries. And I'm most interested in research and your research program. You led a research program, you pioneered a research program based on a curriculum, the MBSR curriculum you developed. Maybe we start out for folks about your development of a curriculum. It's a testable curriculum. And I looked back at all the studies and research that were done in the 1970s and 60s. There wasn't much. And you probably are the only one, the originator of a curriculum to be tested in the world. I don't know if you've thought about it that way. Like, your curriculum was the first testable one. Did you think about it in a way, like the research lens I'm thinking about it at the time?
I didn't think about it so much as a curriculum. I saw it more as a profound opportunity for people falling through the cracks of the healthcare system to be given a new kind of perspective on how to participate in their own trajectory moving forward in life towards potentially regulating their health and well-being through a fairly rigorous, intensive engagement with mindfulness meditation as a formal meditation practice, and also as a more generalized or globalized way of being in the world. So it wasn't so much that I was looking to form a curriculum, which would be the right way to do it. It was much more intuitive, and just the sense that if we really wanted to teach meditation in a way that people would not just have a nice experience for a period of time and find it beneficial, but that it would actually persevere in their lives for years and decades, which was my goal, then it really felt to me that they had to have a long enough experience to actually experience boredom and defeat and non-interest, and then but have it be interesting enough so that they would stay with it until some kind of afterburner kicked in and they realized that this isn't some kind of short duration program, but is really a new way of being in relationship to one's life as it's unfolding. And my intention was always that, realizing that not everybody would take to it that way, but that my intention from the start was I wanted it to be interesting enough and powerful enough and compelling enough that people would actually practice for life, that they would, in all sort of ways in which that phrase has meaning, but that they would be so moved or changed or in some sense awakened by it, that mindfulness would become a major vector in the unfolding of their lives. I also intended from the beginning not that it be a new therapy, because I didn't have credentials as either a psychologist or a physician. although I'm a professor of medicine, very unusual in that my background is in molecular biology and I have a PhD, not an MD. But the whole idea of this was that it be, in some sense, a public health intervention that people with chronic illnesses for whom their medical treatments only went so far and they were still in pain or they still had symptoms and they still had conditions that eroded the quality of their life, that this was a kind of early on sense that people could participate in their own trajectory towards greater levels of health and well-being, starting from wherever they were. You know, including, say, a day before dying, but most of the people we saw were outpatients. So it was very much like chronic conditions with long-term kind of sort of duration, so that the average duration of the symptoms that people were coming with was about 8 years. So really a chronic conditions of various kinds in medicine. And the idea was, if we could run a program that was long enough to affect people's lives in the way I just described, but short enough so that we didn't lose most of the people. And we ran this program in and out over the years. And physicians referred their patients to them when they no longer knew what to do for them anymore, where they weren't really complying with their regimens that were limited in any event. Then over days, weeks, months, and years, and decades, we might actually move the bell curve of medicine to a more participatory kind of engagement on the part of medical patients, so that it wasn't all about the medicine or the surgery, the drugs and the surgery will do it for you, and you don't have any involvement in this. You're a passive recipient of treatment, as opposed to an actively engaged agent in your own health at every level, from the atomic and the molecular and the cellular, right up through epigenetics and the brain and telomeres and whatever you want to measure. At the time that I started, of course, as you pointed out, it was 1979, and people knew nothing about neuroplasticity, never mind epigenetics or telomeres and telomerase. So as MBSR unfolded over the decades, more and more technologies became available to actually look deeply into what was going on in this, what wound up being an 8 week long course that was designed to teach people how to take better care of themselves as a complement to whatever their medical care providers were doing for them.
Thank you. Yeah. So it's a much bigger perspective than a curriculum. And I'm really interested in this period, this early development period, because from a standpoint, I get really nerdy during this period, and I count the publications and try to see what was going on in the 70s in the research world. So from the lens of research. And so the reason I think that still saying that this curriculum, and that there's definitely a bigger underpinning of the reason and philosophy for developing it. But for me, the reason I see the curriculum being outstanding at that moment was because if I examine the 20 studies, there are about 20 studies that are being published empirically, mostly in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology at the time.
Yeah,
I don't know about the time.
Most by Dan Goleman.
Richie Davidson was in there early doing some stuff.
Well, Richie and Danny were actually graduate students together at Harvard, and I knew them back in that day. And also Roger Walsh did some big publications there when he went on retreat at IMS for 3 months and on several occasions, and then wrote about it from a first person perspective. And he was, I think, both an MD and a PhD. And so he was, you know, these are the kinds of papers that were being published, as you say, in the 70s.
Yes. And so the interesting piece to that is, all of a sudden, I believe that the shift that MBSR offered was absolutely essential, because if you read the titles, the abstracts, and the results of those papers, how could you get an entire culture on board when you were using meditation specific terms, which people at the time, there was a subgroup probably understanding it. But in my reading from a scientific lens, I was like, oh, I wonder at the time, was this interpretable at the wide scale? And they could have meshed it together and been like, oh, well, meditation generally, but we, you know what, we still don't know what it is. And it couldn't be taken seriously.
It was beyond, in some sense, it was relegated to the sort of outer realms beyond the lunatic fringe in a certain way. If you use the word meditation in any kind of scientific or medical circle, you were immediately sort of put in a box of kind of a very strange drug crazed hippie kind of thing, because it was, after all, the 60s and the 70s. And so, yeah, there was that kind of zeitgeist at the time that bringing meditation into the mainstream of medicine was, as I sometimes like to joke, but it felt very much this way, tantamount to the Visigoths are at the gates of the citadel of Western science and civilization, about to completely destroy everything that we've worked so hard for hundreds of years to develop kind of a rational scientific basis for understanding medicine, which of course was like very kind of limited actually in its possibilities. And what meditation was basically saying is, there's a whole other universe of ways of being in wise relationship to the experience of being human. And if you really want to treat kind of chronic disease processes that have so much pain and suffering associated with them in different ways, then you have to recruit what I like to call the inner dimensional resources of the patient. And my chief of medicine, Jim Dallin, used to say, if you want to know what's going on with the patient, ask the patient. And mostly young doctors were taught to do differential diagnosis, but the last thing they would do is ask the patient what they think, because, well, how would they know? They're not experts in medicine. But actually, people are experts in their own lives, and they give enormous amount of indicators, if you listen deeply, to what's really going on, what the deep forces are that are at work, the stressors that are at work in their lives and in their families and in their jobs and so forth. And very often, it's the, as we know now, it's the accumulation of those effects of constant unmitigated stress without appropriate ways to modulate that stress, that often over days, weeks, months, and years again, tip things in the direction of dysregulation.
And so you may be really interested in this fact and maybe aware of it, because it really, I see it as a historical precursor in the research world and the publication world of what opened the floodgates. And there's this 1975 publication named J.C. Smith out of Michigan State University Department of Psychology. And this was published in Psychological Bulletin, can you believe it, 1975, Meditation as Psychotherapy, a review of the literature. And it was mostly around transcendental meditation. I think there's addressing mindfulness meditation. At the time, there were so few, like I mentioned, like you couldn't really interpret.
I didn't even know that study. I don't know that paper.
There are no controls, but basically their end line was that therapeutic benefits could be found. Possibly it's expectation of relief or simply sitting on a regular basis. And then we could begin. I mean, that to me was a signal, like, let's get going. Let's see what's happening here. Is it something real? Are we setting up just the expectation of a health benefit? Is it just sitting and doing something new? And then I was like, oh, this was the moment. And maybe it was just by chance. And I'm like, John's work really filled that void to say, if we're going to do it, you had, and I'm sorry, I keep calling it a curriculum, but just from my scientific
mind.
No,
it is a curriculum. There is an MBSR curriculum.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like a Zen koan, what is MBSR? And in our professional training programs to become an MBSR teacher, you can't just sort of get what's called in the trade a treatment manual and start teaching MBSR by following how it's unfolded in the treatment manual. That may contain an explicit curriculum, but it's actually light years away from the real curriculum. And the real curriculum has to include you as the instructor and what your own relationship to your own mind and body and health is, and in particular to your own meditation practice. And so there's an explicit curriculum, as it's sometimes said, and then an implicit curriculum. And it's very, very challenging, especially in this era, to just jump ahead a few decades when everybody wants to teach MBSR. It's very challenging to communicate and convey that the curriculum that's in the book has to be married to the curriculum that's in your heart, and that requires deep practice over a long period of time that sometimes looks like nothing, but it's actually sitting with your own mind and body and discovering or uncovering or recovering the universe of experience that's there, and how easily we wind up falling into a contracted mind states and body states that then actually create problems that over time can actually lead, I believe, to chronic medical conditions, because they weren't, in some sense, recognized as kind of incipient opportunities to take your own health and well-being to a whole other level by honoring signs and symptoms and things like that, and not having a kind of total preoccupation with what's wrong with me, with diagnoses and so forth, but asking deep questions about what's right with me and how to nurture that in very systematic ways over time. And so when people would be sent to us from their physicians, they'd usually come with medical diagnoses. And and many of them even with like cancer diagnoses. And I would find myself saying, look, from our perspective, what you have to understand about these next 8 weeks is that we're going to take the perspective that there's more right with you than wrong with you, no matter what's wrong with you, no matter what diagnosis you're, and we're going to pour energy in the form of meditative awareness and attention into what's right with you for the next 8 weeks and just see what happens. And, you know, when you've had four back surgeries for chronic pain and you feel like you're at the end of your rope, which a lot of the people that were sent to us came with that kind of, history. It's like throwing people a lifesaver, you know, after the ship is, you know, sort of floundered. And so they may not understand what meditation is, but they can feel that just the proposition that there might be something right with them, and that we could cultivate greater intimacy with it and begin to exercise muscles that many people don't even know they have, and that there is more right with any of us than there is wrong, and how we can nurture that rightness into true well-being and flourishing at every level of our biology, which now we have the technology to actually see, whether it's neuroplastic changes or whether it's, you know, epigenetic changes or whether it's all these different technologies for measuring that. It turns out that the practice of non-doing and what looks from the outside like nothing, which meditation often from the outside looks like people are just falling asleep, not doing anything. It turns out that that has profound effects on every level of our humanity, including social effects, including our relationship with the environment and with other beings, including human beings, because as we change, one of the things we recognize is how profoundly interconnected we are with the rest of the universe and each other. And that changes how we actually modulate our awareness, our thinking, our emotions, our communications, our choices, our parenting. Everything is influenced by this kind of bigger apprehension of what the full dimensionality of my being, and I'm putting it very much in the first person, my being is, when you begin to apprehend and appreciate what the envelope of the skin actually contains. So it's like, in some sense, it's an awakening, and it's also a last chance. A lot of people say, well, you were my last, you know, chance, because there were no other treatments. There were no other surgeries. There were, I've done all the drugs and all, you know, I'm at the end of my rope. And we would say, well, then you have nothing to lose and everything to gain. And yet we're not trying for you to get anywhere else. It's not like we want you to even improve. What we're actually saying is that there's no improving on you, even if you have cancer at the moment, that you're whole in a certain sense. And as we said, there's more right with you than wrong with you. Let's apprehend that wholeness, and let's, in some sense, unleash it so that it can actually function at every level that we understand human functioning, from the cellular and the intracellular to, you know, the brain, and then interpersonal.
So it seems like these deep insights were probably starting out. You mentioned patients that were falling through the cracks. I have many of my graduate students go back and read your 1982 paper. They're interested in mindfulness meditation, as you said, culturally, we're interested in it. But I said, go back and really figure it out. Imagine the context when someone was trying to create a seminal idea, produce the seminal work, and get a message across. And can you innovate in a similar way in your own research career? It's not easy. So why don't you tell our readers that 1982, and let me just tell people, it's such an important and seminal work, and the first test of MBSR, I believe, published in General Hospital Psychiatry, and it's titled An Outpatient Program in Behavioral Medicine. So you contextualized it broadly. For chronic pain patients, so exactly what you were saying, and based on the practices of mindfulness meditation. So This, for me, when I observed that, as I was saying, contextualizing it in that psychological bulletin review, and then you see this one in a well-known clinical journal, and then as you read that, you're like, oh, this is something for the first time I can replicate. So this is my scientist hat on. I'm like, and that's why I personally enjoyed the word curriculum, because I see the scientific purview of this, which to me is, can we replicate over and over and over with this population and others? And you set the stage for allowing us to do that in this work. Can you take us to 1982, like this project starting for you, recruiting patients, like seeing your MBSR program materialize for people, and then having the numbers to say something about it? People often wonder about this original study.
Well, thank you for that question. Going back to 1979, when I started the clinic, first of all, you have a molecular biologist from MIT who'd never taken a course in psychology in his life, in a department of medicine, and developing a clinical program for medical patients who, as I said, metaphorically are falling through the cracks of the healthcare system, and literally for that matter. And that's in 1982. Now in, you know, 2021, the cracks in the healthcare system are now grand canyons, chasms in the healthcare system, which is not really a healthcare system. It's more a healthcare payment system in many ways. And so this dimension of things really still, after 40 plus years of research and exponentially growing research, still is not so well understood. And its popularity is more out in front of its understanding than is really helpful. Okay, so this is where the curriculum comes in, because the curriculum includes the instructor and what how the instructor needs to be in wise relationship with him or herself, and also with the 30 or 40 people in the room, because these are big classes, MBSR, or at least especially because if you want to move the bell curve of the entire society, you don't do it sort of on a sort of single patient basis. Doing large numbers of people. Also, when people meditate together, you have the sort of very interesting kind of interpersonal connectivity that arises when a whole bunch of people are doing the same thing and then talking about their deep interior experience and sharing those experiences with each other. So while it seems like there's one instructor in the room, there are actually as many instructors in the room as there are people in the room, because we're all learning from each other. And then because I was trained as a scientist, although I studied bacteriophage and bacteria, so very different from studying people. So I had to get a kind of rapid tutorial from various friends on how to do outcome studies with human beings. But it was obvious to me from the beginning that if I didn't have a research program, if I didn't start documenting outcomes from the very beginning, that no matter how successful this was, it would go nowhere, because it would just be what's called in the medical field anecdotal, right? And so nice anecdotes. So they're having wonderful results over there at UMass in the hospital, and people say, oh yeah, it's some kind of magic, or they're doing meditation, or John's a genius, or whatever it is. And it would have no impact in the world. And since the basic motivation was to actually have that kind of public health transformative effect of moving the bell curve of humanity itself towards greater awareness, towards greater embodied wakefulness, as a kind of catalyst towards true health. Because when we talk about health, we don't actually even know what we mean. We know what we mean when we talk about disease processes, and we can drill down to the molecular nature of many diseases. But at the same time, is health merely the absence of disease? Of course not. But then what is robust health? And is the health of a man the same as the health of a woman? Obviously, yes and no. Is the health of a two-year-old the same as the health of an 82-year-old? Well, yes and no. I mean, the one thing that we noticed early on in the clinic was that everybody who comes in the door, whether they come in on their own 2 feet or they come in a stretcher, as sometimes happen, or in a wheelchair or on crutches, there was not a single human being in all those years, starting in 1982, that didn't come in breathing. Everybody was breathing. And everybody, as we say in English, has a body. So that was like really important place to start, because it's starting with what we have in common. Not only that, we never recognize that we're breathing. We're not aware, unless we're choking or drowning. We take the breath totally for granted, as we do the body, as we do our eyes and our ears and our nose and all of the amazing miracles of sensation, as we do with even the miracle of thought or emotions. So mindfulness is really about recognizing the miraculous nature of all of this, and then not taking any of it personally, because when you investigate who's meditating or who's breathing even, or who's in pain, all of which are part of this curriculum, then you can't really say me, because that's just a personal pronoun. If you know, even if you use your name, you're not your name, you're not your age, you're not your gender identification. You're so much bigger than all of those things, and your narratives about who you are, because you can tell the story 50 million ways, depending on how depressed you are at the moment, or how anxious, or how much of an impression you want to make on whoever is asking. So who the hell are you? So this is actually the real curriculum of MBSR, is to bring people into a room where we can actually all practice inquiring together on the nature of being human while we still are alive. And we're only alive now in the present moment. The past is gone. The future hasn't happened yet, although we live most of our lives, if you start to watch where the mind is, most of the time it's in the future, planning or worrying. or it's in the past perseverating and, you know, they're getting caught up in who did what to whom and who was to blame and why it didn't work out or how great I was then and what a mess I am now. And all of that, none of that, of course, has any remote bearing on the actuality of what we might call the truth of things. They're just thoughts. But when you don't know that they're thoughts, then you're basically a prisoner of your own mental fabrications and of the emotional turmoil that usually is associated with. Once you realize that, it's not like that you have to improve on yourself. It's like all of a sudden you have a whole other dimension, what I like to call an orthogonal dimension that's been here all along, which is called human awareness. You don't even have to get it. You are it. You were born with this. It's not something you have to acquire. It's just that it gets, sort of weedy and thorny, and, you know, our access to it becomes impeded because we've never practiced getting there or exercising the muscle to recognize it. So when people walk into the MBSR classroom, what we're really documenting, no matter what we're studying and what we talk about as outcomes, those outcomes that we can actually nail down and publish in journals are sort of only a small fraction of what really is worthy of documenting in a certain way, because people feel, and they will often say it at the end of the 8 weeks, you gave my life back to me. And it's not like my pain is necessarily just entirely gone away, but I have a new way to be in relationship to it. It doesn't have to destroy or erode the quality of my life. And then they'll give you examples of how in 8 weeks it's not, and before it was. And I'll have to say, or any of the teachers who do this, and there are thousands of people out there now doing this in wonderful ways, we'll have to say, you know, we didn't do this for you or to you. You found resources within yourself to let this kind of unfolding, flourishing realization happen. And it's not a one-time phenomenon. It's not like, oh, you had a good day. This is something where, you know, you can live in this way as your default mode, so to speak, that every moment, every breath could be inhabited and embraced in awareness. And then whatever's going on with you, you have this new degree of freedom for how to be in wise relationship to it. And that's where the differentiation, say, between pain and suffering comes in. That, you know, as long as we have bodies, we're going to have symptoms of one kind or another sooner or later. And sometimes they will be really uncomfortable, unpleasant. How we are in relationship with the unpleasant, that's something we can train. You know, this is the second foundation of mindfulness in the classical tradition, is like what's called Vedanas. How are you in relationship to the pleasant? Oh, well, obviously, I want more of it. I want just as much pleasant as I can get. And how are you in relationship to the unpleasant? I don't want any unpleasant in my life, and I want to run from it as fast as I can. And what about the neutral? What about the not pleasant, not unpleasant? Well, usually I don't even notice that. Well, that's probably 90% of your life that you're not noticing. And maybe if you notice that, it become interesting in ways that might be revealing and even pleasant or even illuminating. And even unpleasant experiences, when you put out the welcome mat for them rather than try to build walls and wall yourself off from it, which just is a prescription for more pain and more suffering. There's a whole curriculum inside this that is truly illuminating and liberating, because you discover, and we don't have to tell people this, we don't teach people this, they're teaching us, they're reporting this, that they're not, they realize that they're not their pain. They realize that they're not their depression. They're not their anxiety. They're not their thoughts. They're not their emotions. And they're not their narratives about who they are. Well, when you realize that, then all of a sudden, that's a new way to inhabit this one moment. And if you're willing to inhabit this moment fully with awareness, without an agenda, so to speak, the next moment is completely different than what it would be if your agenda was, I can't live in this body anymore because it's driving me crazy. It's so horrible. It's so painful. All of those are thoughts. You're living in the body, no matter how horrible or painful, but you're stuck and imprisoned in it, in part because of the lack of awareness of what your thinking is doing. You know, in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, this is referred to as depressive rumination, you know. But when you're not aware of the depressive rumination, you're just in the black hole of depression. If it's like we're talking clinical depression, major depressive disorder. But with awareness, all of a sudden, you realize that the prison, that the gate is open. All you need to do is open the door, step out. And it's always moment by moment. It's always this moment, this breath. So that gives you this like fungibility that nurtures what I like to say, metaphorically speaking, in some ways, is deepest and best in what in who we are and what makes us human. And then it's like, then you see people, you see why people say, well, you gave my life back to me. They say, well, we didn't do a thing. You did it yourself, but maybe we helped you along by pointing out certain kinds of things, but you have to, we can't exercise a muscle for you. You have to do it yourself.
So you chose everything you're saying, the mechanism of unraveling what is best and truest in us. From a scientific lens, what we often are trying to do is find a best model to show the point that this underlying truth about what you think is happening. So everything you just described, in your use of a sample of pain patients, and you went on to publish more papers and documenting what you thought was a classic, like empirical mechanism that you use different language with, like self-regulation, and we can go more into that. But the first point I'd like to talk about is the selection of a sample of pain was probably more, from a scientific lens, an extremely useful model, because everything you're saying, and here I'll give a personal example, then we can work on it some more. In early on, when I'd be taking a mindfulness course and we were doing body scans, there were days, as you said, it was uncovering that nothing was necessarily of great interest. The body wasn't calling me. Many things were neutral. And the recognition and awareness that neutrality was kind of a pleasant state to be residing in, and everything in that moment was fine. And so I didn't have chronic pain in those moments. I imagine in a model like that, you can have participants with a lot of variance because, you know, most people be like, well, it's neutral. Life is good. Everything's fine. But to uncover what you are saying, a pain sample, a sample of chronic pain is the excellent, outstanding sample to use, right? Because their bodies are calling to them in a very harsh way, right? It is saying everything is asking for your attention to be called on the physiology of pain, the discomfort in your back, the pain in your wrist, et cetera, right? So you uncovered, because we're looking for change or an observation that a program can uncover something as clear as a person with severe pain can subjectively see both states of pain and non-pain. And then through that, you say, oh, there is a resolution to some degree that we capitalized on here, that we found an additional way to understand healing. So I just want to point that out, that the selection of a pain model scientifically was brilliant. And maybe you were just doing it at the time because it made sense. But do you want to talk about pain specifically anymore? Like your understanding of embodiment, the relationship with person's mind and pain seems like essential to everything you say. Was there that recognition about this model you were using in your research career early on?
Yeah, in the sense that the meditation practice itself comes out of a tradition that emphasizes the ubiquity of suffering. The model is called in Buddhism the Four Noble Truths. And it's actually in the form of a medical kind of model, where the Four Noble Truths are: one, that the actuality of there is the actuality of suffering. Okay, it's not life is suffering. It's often mistranslated that way or misunderstood that way. But it's that there is suffering. Okay, that's the diagnosis. Then that suffering really has to do with how we are in relationship to it. That's the etiology. That and the cause of that suffering, the proximal cause of that suffering, is attachment, is a self-identification. Is a certain kind of desire that it not be that way. Okay, so that's a very radical statement, but that is stated to be the etiology of what's called adventitious suffering. It's not like, you know, it's the suffering that we add to whatever it is. If, of course, if there's a tsunami and we lose our house and people die, there's that. But we're talking about how you are in relationship to that. So the first... the diagnosis is we have to deal with suffering. There's the actuality of suffering. And of course, that's a big umbrella. So suffering of all kinds, including emotional suffering, you know, physical suffering, pain, and the interesting distinction between pain and suffering. Okay, so the etiology is ultimately the statement, and it's a very radical statement. It's how you attach to your understanding of what your experience is. Okay. The third of these truths is the prognosis. And the prognosis is very positive, that if you do a certain kind of work in transforming your relationship to the pain, then it is potentially liberative. It is transformative. And we don't have to let the pain lead to suffering. Okay. And then the fourth is the treatment plan. So diagnosis, etiology, prognosis, treatment plan. And the treatment plan formally is called the Eightfold Noble Path. Mindfulness is the first of those path factors, but all the eight path factors are kind of like different facets of the same crystal. So you go in any side of the crystal, you're in the entirety of the crystal. And what MBSR does is to try to take that model and make it real in the world for people who are never going to even learn that there is something called the Four Noble Truths, or use the word Dharma or the word Dukkha, which is the Sanskrit term for, and it's very hard to translate. Often it's translated as suffering, but it has a million different levels of dissatisfaction, out of jointness. So everything that's wrong in your life. And the prognosis is, hey, it's possible to wake up and then nothing will be wrong with your life without anything even having to change. And therefore, pain, when you have a body, while you have a body, is, you know, just part of the realm. But whether you suffer as a result of that pain, that's a whole different story. And that's where wisdom comes in. That's where we speak about it as liberative in a certain way. It doesn't mean that you're not going to cry. It doesn't mean that you're not going to hurt. It doesn't mean that you're not going to grieve. It doesn't mean that you're in some sense superhuman and you're not going to have all the experiences of the full catastrophe of the human condition. What it means is you have a whole other dimension that you can inhabit to hold the entirety of that in a way that you don't compound the suffering, that you don't add to the suffering, and that in some sense releases the pain of it all into not suffering so much as wisdom, embodied clarity, kindness, compassion, in the only moment you ever have, which is this one. So it's not like, oh, practice for 100 years and then you'll be some kind of saint. It's like, no, this is it. If you take this beyond time and space approach as a chronic pain patient, then we have no alternative but to put the welcome mat out to whatever arrives and then see how we might be in relationship to it so it doesn't erode the quality of our life. So the pain, chronic pain patients came about because I went and spoke with the head of the chronic pain clinic there about whether they had any interest in sending people to the new stress reduction clinic. And they said, well, you know, I mean, we have hundreds of people that we actually don't help that much with our treatments, you know, which are very medical based and often spinal cord, anesthetics and stuff like that. Now they have, you know, this is like 40 years ago. Now they have other kinds of, but there's no more chronic pain clinic in the hospital because it wasn't actually that effective. So what we were demonstrating was that people with chronic pain conditions can self-regulate, as you said, that word is in the title, because in those days, that was the language that was being used in this kind of meditative interface with psychology, that self-regulation. We now understand it on a whole other level of the brain and the nervous system and epigenetics and so forth. But still, the term self-regulation is valuable because it basically empowers people to be, as I said, a participant in their own, the arc of their own lives and movement potentially towards greater and greater levels of health and well-being, starting from no matter what age, no matter what diagnoses or conditions, and also over the lifespan, that this is a lifetime's work. And so the 8 weeks of the MBSR were always meant to be like a Cape Canaveral, a Cape Kennedy launching platform for if you tasted something in these 8 weeks about what often in the old days was called self-efficacy. You know, if you just that you had a certain kind of agency to relate to the good, the bad, and the ugly in your own life and the medical consequences of a lot of it, then, you know, that was an extra advantage in living a life that optimized well-being and minimized suffering. And to research that is like a big challenge because we only had limited tools at the time. I also had no money because I had no track record in any of this kind of thing. I applied for an NIH grant to do a very big chronic pain study and, you know, and got all sorts of people in the hospital to put their names on it, the head of cardiovascular medicine, the head of the pain clinic, the head of the orthopedic clinic, and wrote a whole grant in 1980 about it. And then I had no idea what to do with it because they'd never heard of mindfulness. And I had no track record. And I was a molecular biologist actually running clinical programs in a medical center, you know, as a professor of medicine. And like, it did not compute. Now the NIH funds scores at least of millions of dollars of mindfulness research every year. And in 1979, the idea that that would have happened, I like to sometimes say, is like less probable than that the expanding universe as a, you know, result of the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, that all of a sudden that expanding universe would grind to a halt and collapse back on itself instantaneously. That was probably more probable than that the NIH would fund mindfulness research. And now look, it's happened in 40 years, less than 40 years, because they've been doing it for at least 10 or 15. So this is a kind of paradigm shift of a certain way. And yet still it's in its infancy, because I don't think people understand what's really at stake here. And it's very easy to misunderstand mindfulness as being, you know, a curriculum that you can build a what's called a treatment manual around. And then anybody who has a PhD or a social work degree or anything having to do with healthcare, that person could just come in, follow the book, and transmit whatever needed transmitting and call it MBSR or MBCT. But the fact is, you need decades really of your own meditation practice to be able to walk into that room and sort of not teach out of a script, but unscripted, let that curriculum, which is a very real and fixed curriculum, and you can't just throw out the pieces of it or do what you want with it, but nevertheless, to know how to use it, you're the most important part of the curriculum if you're going to, you know, walk in there as a teacher. And people are watching how you are. Most of the teaching's not about techniques or anything like that. In fact, I never call mindfulness a technique. It's a way of being. And you have to embody that way to a large degree, and it can't be faked. It can't be an act. So how you train young teachers who really have motivation to do this so that MBSR doesn't become a kind of caricature of itself, that is a big time challenge right in this moment, because as you know better than anybody on the planet, the level of interest is growing exponentially, and people come with kind of limited mindset about like meditation is just like anything else. You just learn how to do it or learn how to read a script. Sometimes meditation is taught clinically by reading a script, and the person who's reading the script doesn't even know what the words mean. And that's not mindfulness, not MBSR, couldn't possibly be. So it has to be embodied. So this is, I think, a 1,000-year project. It's not a 20 or 30 or 40-year project. Where the evidence and the trajectory so far seem to be pretty promising, but it could tank in a way if it becomes denatured or reified into a kind of, let's say, cognitive behavioral approach, like a million other cognitive behavioral approaches, which do not understand the non-instrumental dimension of awareness, where there's no place to go, as it says in the classical Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra, there's no place to go. What do you mean? I mean, I came to this clinic, I'm suffering. I mean, I have like pain. I want to get rid of my symptoms. My doctor told me this was great. And there's no place to go. You're already home. There's nothing to do. The meditation is really a non-doing. And there's no special something that you have to attain to be a better person or to be more relaxed or all the goals that people put down because we ask them about their goals or to be in less pain even. Yeah, sure, put down those goals, but then let go of them and let life simply emerge and learn how to be in what you might call a larger or a wiser and more benevolent or even self-compassionate relationship to the actuality of things. So that means we need to stretch science to actually develop new methodologies for understanding what's happening in a classroom with 40 people. There's also like, if, as I said, everybody's teaching everybody else, what's actually going on in this classroom? I mean, if I'm in chronic pain and someone else who has a chronic pain condition for 8 or 10 years comes in and says, you know what, half of the week, my pain went from a 10 to a 3. And the other person thought, well, I've been practicing with the body scan and I haven't experienced nothing. They are so inspired by hearing that this person who said how miserable their life was 2 weeks earlier, and now all of a sudden they're having a moment that they've longed for 10 or 15 years or 30 or 40 years. So you can see that everybody really is teaching each other. And so it's a very, very complex universe inside an MBSR classroom. And the teacher has to really find their own way to be in not knowing about it so that they don't instrumentalize everything, when the real meditation practice is actually a non-doing. It's non-instrumental. It's very much along the lines of the, you know, 1,000-year-old Chan practice out of, Chinese Zen.
So you're noting the importance, and I agree, of delivery of programs with the scientific term that I'll use here, fidelity. So we deliver a curriculum or whatever we're trying to do at the level and at which we intend to deliver it as it was originated. And so this is a flourish. It's growing. You know, this is always hard to do in any field because you realize there is the potential for a program to work. And then you run into, there's always a numbers problem. And John, you realize this was a numbers problem because you start to teach folks and then you have certificate programs, they teach folks. And you wonder, okay, how do we like track what is actually happening once this lands in the classroom and you have, say, pain patients ready to receive the program? So there are some ways to address this. I've tried this. One of my graduate students and I tried to develop, and others in our field have developed, fidelity assessments where you video record the dynamics of what is happening in the delivery. And at its most simple basis, we have like checklists or rankings of The teacher embodied, the teacher did not judge, the teacher sat in awareness and listened instead of like made judgment on what was just said. They gave opportunities for practice. They didn't just talk the whole time. So you can have, there are ways to do it. But as you said, this is the empirical approach. There might still be nuance. You know, there are like competence scales about the experience of the teacher. And this is great, right? Because at least it gives us a metric of, it looks like it's what's supposed to be happening in there, which is great. Yeah. And it prevents that further going down the line. Like you said, if everything just becomes like an app or do it on your computer, how do we account for any of that dynamic that you mentioned? So the scientific approach, I think, is trying to address some of those fundamental problems. So I think from that, I wanted, what's your perspective then on when people like the go it alone approach or just like mindfulness light, like, oh, let's do a 5-minute mindfulness practice and go back to our counseling session. Do you have thoughts and feelings about how we keep an intact, perhaps science or approach there?
I'm not sure how useful my thoughts and feelings are. Of course I have them. First of all, yes, there are people who I have enormous admiration for, including Becca Crane in Wales and Willem Kuyken at the Oxford Center for Mindfulness in Oxford University, and also the people who are trying to actually develop scales to help teachers actually understand what the core dimensions of being an effective mindfulness teacher would be for any kind of mindfulness-based intervention, not just MBSR, because there are increasingly more and more things that claim to be mindfulness-based. And I like to say, I'm fine with that as long as they are mindfulness-based. And that's something I'm not going to police. Nobody can police the waterfront. So in a certain way, you have to ask yourself, is this mindfulness-based? And what does that even mean? So this is where a kind of deep understanding and practice of, say, the Zen perspective, you know, and koans, like our impossible conundra or situations, that stories that you are presented with where you have to demonstrate some kind of non-attachment to outcome and yet an appropriate response when a response is called for. And it could be silence, it could be walking away, it could be standing on your head, you know, that when you have a taste of that kind of non-dual foundation of practice, then you're basically making a whole new, again, dimension of resources available to yourself that do not have to be scripted. And in fact, to the degree that they're scripted, they're going to be ineffectual, because people know fakes. They can recognize fakes, not on the web apparently now, with like, you know, sort of really digital fakes. You know, pretty soon we won't know anything about what's true or what's not true. But in terms of your own, you know, sort of experience with teachers, you have to watch out for teachers, because teachers can be attached to their own outcome, where they could have their own suffering they're not dealing with. And we see this in all the meditative traditions, that there are teachers who betray the actual Dharma teachings. And they could be even competent or good teachers on one level, but if they're not embodying selflessness, then they've got their own skin in the game. They're attached to an outcome. Well, that's the kiss of death. Okay, because it shows ignorance, delusion, and attachment is kind of root cause of suffering. And not just your own suffering, but other people's suffering. If you are in a trust relationship with other people, and then you betray it. And I'm not just talking about the sexual betrayal, but if you walk into a classroom and you dump a two-dimensional MBSR program curriculum on them, which is like, you know, by the numbers, paint by the numbers. You can't get a Picasso by painting by the numbers, even if you start with some outline of a Picasso. So there's an element of art to this that can only come out of your own lived experience as a mindfulness practitioner. And I mean for life. So that was my intention from the very beginning. I have no idea how it's working out. I have this 1,000-year view that it's not me doing anything. I mean, it's like we're all in some sense in a stream of human unfolding where in some way that I don't think is just kind of ridiculously romantic or absurd, this kind of wisdom is doing itself to us. It's like there's a certain kind of interconnectedness that where the Dharma in some kind of universal way is kind of inviting humanity to wake up. And even our name, the name we gave ourselves as a species, Homo sapiens sapiens, means basically the species that is aware and is aware that it's aware. So Homo sapiens sapiens. But we haven't begun to scratch the surface of human awareness, never mind meta-awareness. Now there are whole fields in science on meta-awareness and spontaneous thought and so forth. Excuse me. So, and they're deeply related to this non-dual meditation practice. It's going to take a long time for this to unfold. And my hope is that the people who are out there teaching MBSR or other forms, that they don't have to be perfect. They just have to be good enough. And good enough means true in some sense to their own deep first person relationship to their own experience, and not trying to sell anything to people and not trying to, in some sense, force people into outcomes, but rather just work with what arises moment by moment by moment and transmit, in some sense, the appreciation of taking your seat or dropping out of all the doing into being for a moment, and then letting your doing come out of being, that actually is possible for us to adopt as a way of being with a capital W. And then we'll see how this unfolds over the next generation or two or three or five, you know, or 100 or 1,000 years. And that's, I'm okay with that. All it has to do is be good enough for now. And of course, that's a pun in many ways, because it's like our experience is, what is it if it's not good enough for now? But we have to put the welcome mat out for all aspects of it, including the unwanted and the aversive aspects of it. And then see that we're so much bigger than our reactivity or our narrative about how much pain we're in or how inadequate we are. And that is liberative. That is freeing. That is the liberation that's at the heart of the practice. And I don't own it. MBSR doesn't own it. No brand owns it. Of course, there are people making billions of dollars off it, because it's also, you know, there's Headspace and Calm and all these apps that are, you know, out there. And I don't know much about them, but they can't be all bad. They've got to be doing something. And then we have to deal with the fact that, you know, we're operating in a capitalist environment. So, yeah, there is money exchange, but what is the value underneath that? And how do the people who accumulate huge amounts of money doing this kind of thing, which to me is like, you know, I have no interest in that. But right livelihood, I have every interest in. I mean, MBSR is a form of right livelihood. The teachers, and a lot of teachers, can't actually make a good living teaching MBSR. So they do it on the side. So it's a very complicated picture. But I feel, to come back to the science, that the science of this, even though it's like 40 years old, let's say, or 50 years old, is really in its infancy. And what we need is, in some sense, a first-person science along the lines of neurophenomenology that, you know, Francisco Varela spoke about, but where we really have ways of understanding the deep embeddedness of individuals within language, within social frameworks, within nature, and within society and planetary, you know, sort of experience, so that we you know, don't lose sight of our ethical responsibility to actually minimize the harm that comes out of us and that comes into the world in all the ways harm comes into the world, and maximize well-being. So this is like the health now writ large on a planetary scale, even beyond nations. And with the climate crisis and all the other crises that we're facing, where we've actually thrown the homeostatic or allostatic processes of the planet out of kilter in a way that could be self-accelerating, that we have to actually take the same kind of public health approach that we took to MBSR and chronic pain patients or other patients with chronic medical conditions falling through the cracks of the healthcare system. We've given the planet a fever. We've got the entire planet is in some sense the patient, and then we have to be the cells of the body politic. Each one of us, in some sense, as a human being, is one cell of the body politic, and we have to learn to live together rather than for the, say, heart to go to war with the liver because it feels it's superior.
Yeah, I feel like we've had years of a question that we've shared together. It's how and why is MBSR and the underlying practice of population and public health sciences type intervention? And I hope you're willing to join me again to have that discussion. I feel like I personally only got us to 1985, and I have so much more to ask you about from the research standpoint. So I hope you would in the future be willing.
Oh, sure. We could do a whole series of these if you like.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Maybe I've sort of galloped away in a certain way from your agenda in terms of the history of the unfolding of the research on MBSR in the early days, or at least in our clinic.
No, the stream took us where it took us. And that's exactly where we should go. So, John, is there any current project you want to let people know about? Are you a teaching program or anything going on right now?
I'm just doing what I'm always doing. And of course, because of COVID and the fact that it's not over, you know, I'm doing virtually everything that I'm doing online. And finding, although... in many ways, you know, I sort of really miss being able to hug people and being able to travel and be face to face, that there's something about the intimacy of Zoom that has its own benefits and its own features that are really powerful. And so my hope is that to come back to the research and say one more thing. I mean, the research, you know, having been trained as a research scientist, I realized that no matter how good things were in, you know, our anecdotal experience in terms of the early days of MBSR, without publishing research results. Now, that first paper you mentioned wasn't a controlled clinical trial, neither are the papers in the 80s or so forth. I mean, most of the papers that I wrote were not controlled clinical trials. We can go into why. And then there were a few papers that were, like, I think, really seminal, but and small clinical trials. But the point is that the science was always meant to be, in some sense, in the service of this larger agenda around moving the bell curve. Okay. And science is the coin of the realm, the lingua franca, so to speak, of medicine and the modernity, so to speak. So I realized that it was important to have data that would help people realize that this is valuable, or at least valid enough to look at. But it's also important to remember, and maybe this can be another conversation, that even with fMRI studies and everything else, the whole field is in its infancy. And so we don't know exactly what we're looking at. And if we just reify the effects of MBSR or mindfulness practice on different areas of the brain, or even how they drive functional connectivity between different areas and so forth, we can get into certain kind of domains where we forget that even there, it's so much bigger than that, because it's not all happening in the brain. It's happening in the heart. It's happening in the cells of the bones and the body, and also in our interbeing, to use Thich Nhat Hanh's language, in our interconnectivity with each other. So there are so many different levels on which this is going on. And I just have a lot of gratitude that the basic strategy worked, that it kicked the snowball down the mountain, and it grew and grew and grew because science actually and the kinds of results that we were seeing, even in uncontrolled trials, never mind in controlled trials, which validated them. And as your work is showing, because you're pulling, you know, all these different studies together and putting them in one place, the overwhelming preponderance of the evidence is that there's something here. And it's really valuable. And when you look at it, it looks like nothing. And so this, what looks like nothing, is a lesson for us, because in some sense, it's inviting us to maybe entertain the possibility that what looks like nothing may turn out to be just about everything. Wonderful. And this is a kind of, you know, koan that I sort of feel, based on my own life of practice and experience, that this is where the envelope of science epidemiology, for that matter, and what's sometimes called interpersonal neurobiology, or whatever the names you want, that this is where that envelope really needs stretching, including that perspective of neurophenomenology, if you will. And moving from a me, from first person singular personal pronouns, which we're so attached to a we, and then that we understanding that it's boundless, just like awareness.
Let's conclude for today, John, on that point. Thank you so much, Dr. Kabat-Zinn. I really enjoyed our conversation together, and I hope we can continue it. Our listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org. That's goamra.org. Where you can support us by becoming a member or a subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.